I'd like you to join me in welcoming back Christopher Kent from the Reserve Bank of Australia. He's going to talk about bonds and benchmarks. It's the first big theme of the day. We're really looking forward to hearing what Chris has to say, so please join me in welcoming him. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Lawrence, and it's great to be back at the Kanga News Debt Capital Market Summit. So the past year in Australia was a bit of a mixed bag in terms of issuance of fixed income securities. Banks' issuance of bonds, that was high in net terms. Issuance of RMBS, residential mortgage-backed securities, by the non-banks was also high. However, in the second half of 2018, issuance by Australian corporations outside of the financial sector was low. Today I'm going to talk through some of those trends. I'm also going to discuss some trends in yields. When I was at this event last year, I noted that spreads between corporate and government bonds had declined to be around their lowest levels since the GFC. Over 2018, spreads on Australian bonds widened in line with global developments. The sharp rise in spreads around the end of the year reflected a greater concern regarding downside risks. And while spreads have narrowed a little in early 2019, they remain wider than when I spoke here a year ago. In the second half of my presentation today, I want to address the risk relating to interest rate benchmarks. These are directly relevant to many of you here, and it's good to see that they'll be discussed at length later today. These benchmarks are right at the very heart of the plumbing of the financial system, and if they were to stop suddenly, this could generate significant financial instability. The clock is ticking for institutions with exposures to LIBOR benchmarks. However, a path for transition away from LIBOR has been cleared, and we encourage all users to be taking the necessary steps to prepare for this change. And while the bank bill swap rate benchmarks, the BBSW, remain robust, there's still some issues that users should be addressing, which I will touch on today. If we work collectively, then we can significantly reduce these risks. But let me start, though, by considering developments in some of Australia's key bond markets. Australia's largest corporate fixed income market is that for financial corporation debt, and of that, bank bonds form a large part. Bank bond spreads widened in line with global developments over the past year or so. Nonetheless, yields remained relatively stable at a low level as the benchmark rates edged down. Over 2019, thus far, both spreads and benchmark rates have fallen. So there's been an appreciable decline in the cost of issuing unsecured debt in this form to very low levels by historical standards. Issuance of bank bonds was quite high last year in net terms. In fact, net issuance was the highest for almost 10 years. That high level of net issuance reflected gross issuance, which was around average, the average we've seen over the past few years at least, and at the same time, maturities in 2018 were at a low level. In addition to strong net issuance, over the past year, the banks have been issuing a larger share of their bonds domestically. You can see that here in the blue bars inching higher. The banks have not just issued less paper overseas, they've also issued a higher value of bonds in the domestic market, and so the domestic share is at fairly elevated levels. Now, often the perception of the domestic market is that it has limited capacity to absorb sizable increases in issuance. However, it appears that the banks were able to issue the extra bonds domestically at a price that was at least as, if not a little more favourable for the banks than the price of bonds issued offshore once we account for hedging costs, as is done here in this chart. So this raises the question of who is buying all of this domestically issued paper. Well, the comprehensive data that we have show that the domestic issuance over the year, at least up to September of last year, was widely held across different sectors. but pension funds bought a disproportionate share of the issuance over that period, almost 25% compared with 5% that they had typically held. In recent months, another notable feature has been the relatively high value of issuance of covered bonds by the banks. This may have been related to the rise in volatility around the turn of the year in domestic and global financial markets. Liaison with the banks suggested that the tighter conditions in funding markets at that time did push banks to issue more covered bonds, since these are viewed as a good option for funding at such times. Having said that, there's still plenty of capacity, though, for the banks to tap into their covered bond lines if they have the need. Let me turn now to non-financial corporations. Over 2018, non-financial corporation spreads followed those of financial corporations and, by extension, spreads in global markets. Issuance in the second half of 2018 was quite low, and the market is off to a slow start in 2019. However, with yields low, this doesn't appear to be a story about companies finding it difficult to obtain funding in bond markets. Moreover, the growth of business debt more generally, as shown here, which includes both bonds and credit extended by banks, that growth has picked up over the past year or more. And this quarter has seen some issuance among resource-related corporations. Notwithstanding that, this is likely to remain a relatively quiet corner of the market for some time, given that resource sector in general has been deleveraging following the end of the mining investment boom. Despite 2018 being a somewhat quiet year for non-financial corporations in this space, a diverse range of corporations have issued bonds over the year. Last year at this conference, I showed some Herfindahl-Hirschman indices, which are a standard way of measuring concentration. The lower the index, the lower the level of concentration, and that means the more diverse is the set of issuers. In 2017, the index for non-financial corporations hit its lowest, in other words, its most diverse levels for some time. There was an uptick in concentration in 2018, but it's still at relatively low levels. So a lot of different types of companies are issuing debt. Let me turn to RMBS markets. In 2018, non-banks issued the second largest amount of RMBS since the GFC, only narrowly eclipsed by 2017 issuance. This was associated with strong growth of non-bank housing loans as they gained some market share from the banks. Spreads widened in line with other markets, although, as you can see here, spreads for non-conforming deals appear to have widened just a little more than for other deals. The noticeable rise in the share of new mortgages extended by non-banks over recent years reflects, in part, the earlier regulatory actions limiting the growth of banks' investor and interest-only mortgages. Banks' tighter lending standards in light of the Royal Commission have also had an effect on their lending activity over the past year or so. Not only did this change in the banks' behaviour contribute to the strong growth of non-bank lending, it may also have contributed to the shift in the nature of the collateral underlying the non-bank securitisation deals. So we can use the Reserve Bank securitisation data set to see three key changes. Focusing on the left-hand panel of this chart, first, the share of investor loans in non-bank securitisations has increased over the past few years, and that's in contrast to the banks. Second, their share of interest-only loans, yes, it's come down, but it's remained relatively high, in contrast to the share of interest-only loans in the bank securitisations, which has come down much more noticeably. And then the third point is that the level of seasoning in non-bank deals has also fallen. In other words, their loans are newer than in the past and newer than for bank securitisations. The fact that the non-banks are bundling up mortgages more quickly into securities suggests that they're writing loans more quickly and therefore reaching the limits of their warehouse facilities. So in summary, over the past year or so, well-rated corporations, both in and outside of the financial sector, have been able to source funding in bond markets. And while spreads on corporate bonds are higher than a year ago, yields remain very low. That's a reflection of the expansionary effect expansionary settings of monetary policy, which is providing support to the economy more generally. So I'm going to change tack now and discuss reform of interest rate benchmarks. Now, because these are intertwined with so much of the financial system's plumbing, the issue has been a long-standing focus of the global regulatory community. Increasingly, it needs to also become a key focus of financial market participants, including many of you here today. And with that in mind, I'd like to provide a brief update on the work underway to strengthen interest rate benchmarks both internationally and in Australia. So let's start with LIBOR. The various LIBORs have long been the key interest rate benchmarks for the major currencies. However, given that they are not supported by a sufficient volume of transactions in wholesale short-term funding markets, it's now widely recognised that these will come to an end. Indeed, the UK FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority, which regulates the LIBOR benchmarks, has made it quite clear that it will not support LIBOR beyond the end of 2021. Now, this is an important issue for Australian financial institutions, which have substantial exposures to LIBOR through derivatives, bonds, and syndicated lending. Now, in order to replace LIBOR, regulators have worked very closely with industry participants to develop alternative risk-free rates, such as SOFR for the US dollar and SONIA for the British pound. The transition to risk-free rates is accelerating internationally across derivatives and bond markets. And it's encouraging to see that Australian banks have recently issued sterling floating rate notes referencing SONIA rather than LIBOR. So new products can reference these benchmarks. But when LIBOR comes to an end, there could be disruptions for many of the existing products that reference LIBOR unless their contracts contain what are called robust fallback provisions. So ISDA, the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, has been taking the lead on this work at the request of the Financial Stability Board. And this is going to involve using risk-free rates for fallbacks for LIBOR, but with an appropriate adjustment to the historical spread between them. So ISDA is expected to finalise these fallback provisions by the end of the year, and we strongly encourage all users of LIBOR in the Australian market to be ready to adopt these new fallback provisions in their contracts. The BBSW rates are important interest rate benchmarks for the Australian dollar. A lot of work has already been done to ensure that these remain robust and will remain robust. This market, where banks raise short-term funding by issuing bills to wholesale investors as a liquid asset, is a long-standing one. The bank bill market, as you can see here, is considerably larger as a share of the Australian major banks' balance sheets than the equivalent markets in the US and Europe. As a result, unlike for LIBOR, there are enough transactions in the Australian bank bill market to support a benchmark. Around a year ago, a new methodology was put in place for BBSW, and this has made it possible to calculate BBSW rates directly from transactions in the bank bill market between banks and wholesale investors. And this required the ASX, market participants, and the regulators to all work together to develop a new infrastructure and market practices. And I would say that the new methodology has performed very well, with much more trading activity, as you can see here, now underpinning BBSW during the so-called rate set window, which is from 8:30 to 10 in the morning. So while BBSW is a robust benchmark, we shouldn't take that for granted. The bank bill market is expected to have a secure future since the assets of managed funds, which continue to grow, supported by superannuation contributions, and those managed funds need to hold some liquid assets, such as bank bills, to be able to meet their redemptions. Despite this, bank bills have been slowly declining both as a share of managed funds assets and major bank liabilities. And this is partly due to liquidity standards introduced over recent years, which have reduced the value that banks place on short-term wholesale funding. Given these trends, we cannot be certain that the bank bill market will always be large enough to sustain BBSW rates as viable benchmarks. If BBSW were ever to cease, the existing fallback provisions in many contracts would be cumbersome, to apply, and they could generate quite a bit of market disruption. So ASIC, which is the regulator, is the regulator of licensed benchmark administrators, and to protect financial stability, ASIC also has the power under the new benchmarks legislation to compel banks to make submissions so that BBSW can still be calculated. However, if the bank bill market no longer existed, this would clearly not be a long-term solution. And that's exactly why we've been working closely with ISDA to strengthen contractual fallbacks for BBSW at the same time as they've been doing that for LIBOR. So that'll involve using the cash rate, which is the risk-free rate for the Australian dollar, as the fallback, again with an adjustment for the historical spread between BBSW and the cash rate. Once ISDA has finalised the fallback provisions, we expect all users of BBSW to adopt them where possible. And for new securities referencing BBSW, the RBA will make it a requirement that these fallback provisions be adopted before the securities can be eligible in the bank's market operations. Currently, this would affect floating rate notes issued by banks, securitisation trusts, and the state governments. Meanwhile, users of BBSW should also be aware that the market underpinning the one-month tenor is not as liquid as it is for the 3- and 6-month tenors. Unlike for these longer tenors, banks have no incentive to issue one-month bank bills. And this is because under the liquidity standards, they would be required to hold an equivalent amount of high liquidity assets, high-quality liquid assets. The few transactions that do occur are mainly ones where investors are selling their bills back to the banks. And while there are enough transactions to directly measure the 3-month and the 6-month BBSW on most days, this has only happened about half the time for 1-month BBSW. And since the new calculation methodology was introduced, 1-month BBSW has been more volatile than 3-month BBSW. And you can see this was particularly evident in mid-January. So the lack of liquidity in the underlying market for 1-month bills appears to be affecting the benchmark. Given these issues, users of 1-month BBSW should be preparing to use alternative benchmarks. This is particularly relevant to the securitisation and derivatives markets, which frequently reference the 1-month rate. And consistent with this, the Reserve Bank is thinking about this issue, given it's relevant to a number of securities that we hold via our own market operations. One option would be for issuers to instead reference 3-month BBSW. Another option is to reference the cash rate. It's going to be important for market participants to evaluate the best options and make progress towards these in a pretty timely manner. The cash rate is best known as the Reserve Bank Board's operational target for monetary policy, but it's also a significant benchmark in Australian financial markets. And the cash rate is administered by the Reserve Bank and calculated directly from transactions in the interbank overnight cash market. So with the transition from LIBOR to risk-free rates internationally, we would expect there to be some corresponding migration away from BBSW and towards the cash rate. This is particularly the case for financial products where it makes sense to reference a risk-free rate instead of a credit-based benchmark. For instance, floating rate notes issued by governments and securitisation trusts could instead tie their coupon payments to the cash rate instead of BBSW. The South Australian Financing Authority recently announced its interest in issuing a floating rate note linked to the cash rate, and that, if it comes to pass, would be a first for Australia. We know very well that there is demand from investors for term risk-free rates. Some benchmark users value having more certainty about their cash flows, since a term rate would be known at the start of the relevant interest rate period rather than being calculated at the end of the period by compounding the cash rate. It could be possible to generate a term rate using the overnight index swap market or the repo market. We're certainly supportive of efforts by the private sector to develop such term rates. However, there would need to be significant effort to develop the appropriate market infrastructure and practices before these could be considered robust benchmarks. Given that, we encourage market participants to consider using the cash rate rather than waiting for the development of a term rate. So in conclusion, there's three main points I'd like to leave you with concerning interest rate benchmarks. It's widely recognised that LIBOR will come to an end. Market participants in Australia should continue preparing for this by moving to alternative risk-free rates and adopting more robust fallback provisions in their contracts. Two, while BBSW remains robust, it would be prudent for all users to adopt the more robust fallback provisions for BBSW in their contracts. And thirdly, users of one-month BBSW should be considering alternative benchmarks, given the illiquidity in the underlying market. We would suggest that participants consider using other robust benchmarks that are already available, rather than waiting for the development of a term risk-free rate. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Lawrence. And I await your questions.
Sure. Thanks, Chris. No surprise, there are a number of questions coming from the audience. Let's go from the top. This isn't the first time the RBA has suggested transition away from one-month BBSW, yet there is no sign of movement. Is some type of compulsion the only answer?
No, I think the understanding of this issue is building over time. I think we've been in talk with various industry participants, which does suggest they acknowledge the issue and would like to also try to work out the best solution. It's not for us to dictate to the market what is the exact optimum best solution here. So I think it's better for the market to work it out.
I might ask my own follow-up to that, actually. Chris, can I ask what seems like an appropriate timeline? I mean, unlike LIBOR, one-month BBSW is not changing, right? We know the imperfections, but equally it's not going away in the format that it currently has. So what seems to you like an appropriate timeline for that kind of awareness to build?
Again, I mean, I think it's not for us to sort of dictate that. I would hope that we can make some significant progress in this direction over the course of this year, because things are sort of moving on this front globally. And as I showed you in my earlier chart, you know, people who are using this use it to a degree somewhat at their own risk, and it's pretty volatile at times. And I think that's a reflection of the illiquidity in that market.
I should say, by the way, while most questions nowadays come in through the electronic system, if you want to do it old school, there you go. can we get a microphone over to the back here? Thanks.
It's Rory Robertson, Westpac Treasury. Chris, thanks for your talk. One of the most important bond benchmarks in any economy is the 10-year government bond yield. And I think in your first chart, you showed that the 10-year government bond yield in Australia has fallen below 2% in recent months for only the second time in maybe half a century. One interpretation of that is that the bond market participants now do not believe that inflation is going to average more than 2% over the coming decade. That is, given that core inflation has been below 2% for the past 3 years, and you know, the trim mean measure of core inflation, which is the Reserve Bank think best measure of core inflation, it's been 1.8% for the past 7 quarters. So markets have seen the Reserve Bank miss its inflation target in recent years, and given the recent slowdown in the economy, the markets now seem to be taking the view that the Reserve Bank's going to, on average, miss its inflation target over the coming decade. So my question is, does the Reserve Bank agree with that interpretation? And if so, what should be done about it?
No, I wouldn't fully agree with that interpretation. I think there are elements there that are correct, but others that are not quite. I think the first thing is that I'd draw your attention to is this is an international phenomenon. Bond rates have sort of fallen back to pretty low levels around the world. And that happened sort of around the turn of the year when growth was a bit lower than expected, and I emphasise the bit. Lower than expected in a range of countries in the advanced world and also in China, as well as that we got lower oil prices, which are sort of keeping inflation, headline inflation, down. So I think there's partly that. The other thing is that's long been a puzzle, particularly through last year, and then it's continued, I think, to a degree. Why is the term premium so low? There is just no risk built into these rates for any increase in inflation, and yet we see wages growth trending up around the globe in a situation of fairly low unemployment. So unemployment rate is especially low in places like the US, but it's also trending down more broadly, including in Europe and in Japan. So wages growth is picking up, and that's the sort of thing you'd want to see a lift in inflation, and yet markets don't price that risk in at all. The term premium is very low. So I don't think it's just an Australian phenomenon. What we have here, though, is a gradual pickup in wages, helped by, over the past while, unemployment rates moving to lower levels, quite low levels in New South Wales and Victoria. The question is, will that be picking up sufficiently soon enough to give us some comfort or not? And I think that depends on the outlook, and that's something we're going to be sort of considering and updating as new data comes to hand, as we do from month to month.
Okay, back to the iPad. There's a few to get through. We'll see how many we can manage. This is one on repo. Secured funding rates in Australia have persistently traded higher than equivalent tenor BBSW. Why is this happening, and is this now a structural feature of our money market?
Well, I think all short-term money market rates have been elevated of late, and there are lots of suggestions as to why, some of them good, some of them not so good. I think part of it, and the things that we've pointed to, is just that there's a sort of a inability and a reluctance of banks to use their balance sheets in the same way as in the past to take advantage of these potential pricing opportunities. So the supply of the short-term funding is a bit less, while demand sort of remains high. And you see that particularly around quarter-end periods and year-end periods, when some of these regulatory and tax restrictions domestically, but also, more importantly, internationally, come to bite.
Okay, back to BBSW specifically. How will a new risk-free benchmark improve the relevance of the RBA cash rate to market pricing, given that BBSW has decoupled from cash in recent times and is potentially driven more by offshore market dynamics than the cash rate and domestic factors?
Well, I would say it's only been decoupled by a little bit. There's only a small wedge there. It hasn't been growing that much over the past year. It's going up and down around quarter ends, not every quarter end. Last September it didn't do this, but December it did. Again, this sort of movement is a bit of a global phenomenon. It's not unique to us. I would just say the differential is fairly modest in the scheme of things. And over a long period of time, if you look at the BBSW versus the cash rate, they move fairly closely together. But it's not one for one, and that's fine.
Okay, next one. With the increasing adoption of the cash rate as a reference note rate to floating rate notes, would this change how the RBA views the official cash rate at all?
No.
I just asked them. There you go.
No, that's fine. No, my answer is no.
Okay, look, maybe we'll just take one more. Similar to the first one, what will make the Australian FRN market move off three-month BBSW while that rate is still robust and based on real transactions?
I'm not suggesting it should move off three-month BBSW. I think three-month BBSW is quite a robust benchmark at the moment, and one hopes that that maintains the case. But I think it's just more a matter of people thinking very carefully about what is the appropriate benchmark. What are the appropriate benchmarks in terms of, well, do I want credit risk in my benchmark or not? And if you don't want credit risk in your benchmark, then maybe BBSW is not the appropriate one for that particular instrument.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. I think we'll leave it there in the interest of time. Apologies to the people who sent questions we didn't have time to get to, but please join me in thanking Chris. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you. Thanks very much.